Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Lights on Data show. Today, I'm very excited to talk about fostering those synergies between enterprises and the AI machine learning teams for that seamless integration and collaboration. And to do so, I have Brad Mickley, founder and CEO of Jozu and the project lead for the open source kitops.ml project. Welcome, Brad.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Now, it seems like there's a gap. There's a gap between the AI machine learning teams and the business. Before we go into some of those practical takeaways and solutionings and your advice and recommendations on how to bridge that gap, can you please just share your insights on what do you see as the current state of collaboration between these two?
Yeah, well, I guess in a word, there isn't much. a little bit more detail, though. I think a part of why there isn't much is because it starts with a single point of friction, which is that AI models and machine learning, all of these kind of things are by their nature non-deterministic. Mm-hmm. These are not like software applications where if you put the same input in every time in the front, you're always going to get the exact same thing out the back. And businesses really like deterministic things. They like to know that if you put something in the top, it's going to come out the bottom in a certain way. And so you've got this friction, I think, between this non-deterministic world of AI and the deterministic world of business. And I think it's made worse by the fact that in a lot of cases, leadership doesn't have a really clear vision and goal for how they want to use this new, somewhat challenging, but very powerful technology in AI as a part of their business. And it sounds easy to say the AI project needs to serve the customer and needs to serve the business, but the nuance of how it does that is I think a little bit difficult.
And it's ironic because the business that it's prompting this and they're the ones asking every single day, hey, we need AI, we need to implement AI. Sorry, go on.
No, that's exactly it. You've got this pressure, I think, from the top to say, we need AI. And if you leave it up to an AI ML practitioner, they're going to go and try and fill that void as well as they can. But in most cases, data scientists, ML engineers, I'm just going to probably end up using the word data scientist. I know there's lots of different terms and I don't mean to exclude anybody, but let's say the data scientists, they probably don't have a ton of experience running businesses, mm-hmm. speaking to customers, selling products, supporting customers. And so they don't have that context in order to say, I could do these 100 things, but these three are going to be what's really going to help over here. There needs to be somebody to connect those kind of dots. Yeah.
And so what are some of the other challenges that you're seeing in fostering the synergy between these two?
Yeah, I think they break down, I would say, into kind of two big buckets. There's kind of organizational issues / cultural issues, and then the technical issues. And they're related for sure. On the organizational side, we were just talking a little bit about, you've got, I think, not a misunderstanding, maybe that's too strong a word. Data scientists are new in most organizations. Most organizations have not had data scientists on staff for 10, 15 years. And I think it's easy for people to, especially when terms like ML engineer are used, it's easy to forget that a lot of how these types of skills were developed was in a more academic and research-oriented background. And that's a different world. It's not about how much did you sell, how big is your product, how secure is your enterprise. It's about what experiments did you run? How fast did you run them? How confident were you in the results? And so you've got one group in data scientists who I think, to their credit, and I think was one of the best things about them, is that they have this very experimenty mindset and they want to be able to try a ton of different things. They're going to measure the results. They're going to optimize. And that's fantastic. But on the other side, you've got software developers. You've got site reliability engineers or DevOps engineers. Those folks live in a world where they have service level agreements. And those service level agreements give them, in many cases, only a few minutes a year to have something fail and for it to not result in a business problem. They are very risk averse for that reason. If you've got to get something right 99.999 times, that doesn't give a lot of room for just trying stuff. And so you've got, again, a big kind of chasm between these two types of groups. And that's then compounded by the technical issues. You've got ML teams that have their set of tools. great for experimentation, great for model development, great for tuning, but don't really have a lot of that production flavor of security, compliance, ultimate reliability, determinism. And you don't necessarily have these folks, for good reason, who understand SBOMs and Terraform and Kubernetes. That's not their world. They shouldn't need to understand that. Mm-hmm. And the folks over here, they don't really understand what a non-deterministic model is about. What do we do with that? Like, how is that okay? And so you think of it like the analogy I like to use is, imagine you had to write a document with three other people or two other people. You write it in Word, you send it around. The next person sends you back a handwritten document. The third person sends you back a PDF, but it's not edible. Now you're like, wait, we're supposed to be collaborating on this document, but you're all using different tools. Okay, I guess I'll bring this all into my Word and I'll send it back out. And then the person goes, no, sorry, I need it to be handwritten. So can you send me a handwritten version? Oh, I need it to be a non-editable PDF. Can you send me a non-editable PDF? Like, it would be infuriating. You would get nothing done. But this is exactly what it's like right now in this world, mm-hmm. because you've got code that's in Git, but then it's also in a Jupyter notebook, which doesn't fit well into Git. You've got massive data sets in data lakes and BI tools. They don't fit well in Git. You don't really containerize them. That doesn't make sense. They're not really versioned. You've got parameters and critical settings that are set up in things like weights and biases or MLflow or something like that, that data science teams understand, but your SREs and your software developers don't. So how do you do anything when all these pieces are scattered all over the place?
Yeah, I think you paint a great picture that's multi-levels as well. And I want to touch on the first piece that you mentioned, the fact that within the AI world, you need to do a lot of trial and error. And I can definitely see from the business side how they're not used to that mentality and haven't been used to working more with the traditional IT software developers. And like you said, you have to try many times. And sometimes after all these trials, you find out that actually you need to go to square one and try completely something else in a completely different direction. And other times you find out, you know what, the data that you have available, it's not right for the questions that you're trying to answer. So you need to revamp everything again. So for companies that are not used to that type of being prone to this type of errors and mm-hmm. trying new things that might not work out, and that on its own can be a good lesson, then they get antsy and they're thinking, okay, we wasted all this budget, all these resources on nothing. And that's not always the case. Whereas companies like Amazon, I think, stand out because they have this try often and try quickly, fail often, fail quickly mentality. And it's really helping part of this innovative AI space as well.
No, I think you're exactly right. And I think that this is a great opportunity for a lot of businesses, because I think the most successful businesses have shown that you, if you can embrace that experimental attitude and you can understand that, hey, run experiments fast, fail fast, because you'll learn fast. And when you learn fast, you're more competitive, you're more effective. You can go to your customers with something better, faster. And that's ultimately how you win as a business. But it does take a shift. And I think that the weight of that rests on everybody's shoulders. I think in the AIML space, those teams, they need to spend more time trying to learn about the business, understand the business, and contextualize what they're doing in the right way. Explain that these are going to be experiments, and don't explain it as we're going to fail a bunch of times and eventually we'll get it right, because that doesn't sound super appealing. But talk about what you're going to learn after each of those experiments and how that learning is going to help you get ahead of your competitors or build something better for your customer. If you can contextualize it that way, then I think it helps get people on board early. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I did at AWS running API Gateway is I talked about a learning phase that we would need to go through as a team. We were trying to make some big changes, some really critical changes that would be super helpful for our customers. But it was going to take time, like more than a year. And so we described a first phase that was really a learning phase and all the kind of goodness that would come out of that. And then we talked about more of an implementation phase. And that's where the product came out the other end. And I think you can follow something similar for an AIML project so that you can give people that milestone, give yourself room to run those experiments and have those failures and setbacks, but still help people keep focused on we're getting to a good place.
Yeah, good point. And something else that I want to add is, even from the business side, if you're thinking, okay, I'm going to put more money into this and I'm going to hire more senior data scientists that have a lot of experience, maybe even in my industry, they still need to go through that learning phase, because often enough, the context of your business is unique. It's different from the others. The data that's presented, the anywhere from the terminologies and again, the context itself, you still need to go through that learning phase too.
That's right.
So Brad, you also talked about the technical aspect and all the challenges that are there. I'm curious, from your point of view, the project lead for kitops.ml, how do you envision this sort of open source project facilitating the seamless integration and collaboration between enterprises and the AI teams?
Yeah. So first of all, I have to say, it's not a silver bullet. There are no silver bullets. It's not going to magically solve organizational problems or cultural problems or things like that. But in the context of that communication problem, like that document that needs three different types of ways of doing it, and you've got your code in one place and your data sets, et cetera, that's the problem that we really focused on. We focused on that because both at AWS and Red Hat, and then at my own startup, we had challenges. We had great AI models. We had production environments, and we had a lot of challenges trying to get the AI model into a state where it could be run responsibly in production and interact with customers. It's not easy. It's not as simple as saying it has very high accuracy on my Jupyter notebook run, and therefore it's ready to go. It's not even halfway ready to go. There's a lot more that needs to be done. And so what we did is we've started really because Jozu will have a lot of kind of tools within its arsenal, but KitOps is the first step. We said, what the market really needs is something that is standards-based and can act as that interchange format for the whole AI project. Because the collaboration really can't start unless you're all talking about the same thing. And you can be very confident that you can say, oh, I am working with the thing that George gave me that's at this state. It has these versions inside of it. I know exactly what data set was used. I know exactly what code was used. I knew exactly what model was used. So all that stuff, the model, the data sets, the code, the configuration, all goes into what we call a model kit. And you can think of that as a kind of package, like a box maybe, or a chest of drawers maybe is a better example. That data set, sorry, not the data set, the whole package gets versioned and tagged. So you can essentially say, hey, as the data science team, we have finished training the model. So now we create a model kit. It's tagged trained. It's V1. And then it goes over to QA, and QA tests it. And then they change the tag to tested, and it's V1.1. And you just keep rolling it forward this way and into production. The nice thing is that the data sets then are versioned, and the version of the data set is clearly aligned with a specific version of the model, which is clearly aligned with a specific version of the code, which is clearly aligned with a specific version of all those parameters. You can deploy the model as a container, you can deploy it into Kubernetes, you can deploy it into whatever infra you want. The code can still work with Git, and all of this stuff can be stored in the enterprise registry that the enterprise is already using for all of its containers. So You already have all the authorizations set up, you already know it's secure, it's private maybe. Most organizations want that to be private. And then I think the last piece that was really important to us as well, because a lot of what we had done what was very kind of customer focused and involved customers not wanting to have things shared around with other people, is we wanted to be able to audit the contents of that model kit at any time and be able to determine, is it still in compliance? Who made the changes? What changes were made, and when were they made? And that was super important for things like SOC 2 and stuff like that.
And besides the model itself, do you also store, I don't know, maybe like those steps that one needs to take to get the features, the results of the model, maybe even like a link to the data source and things like that too?
Better than that, the code for the model goes into that package, and the serialized model, and the data sets that were actually used, and the instructions or whatever other documentation you need. So it's actually all in that package. So when you hand somebody that package, you're giving them everything they need to actually operate with that AI project. Now, they can still use a Jupyter notebook with that. They could use a normal code editor. They could use their favorite SQL tool. Whatever tool they want to use, we don't care. We only care that there is a package that can be passed around and used by everybody with the tools that they already like and already use.
I mean, besides enhancing that collaboration, which is amazing, I also find that it's great for reproducibility of yes. that, which is very important. And of course, the transparency piece, which becomes more and more important, and something that, especially as the business seeing AI as black box, it offers a bit of transparency into the inner workings of what goes into that model. So somebody can know exactly where to go to and know the version that they're referring to and be able to provide further details if needed.
That's exactly it. And in fact, this can end up being a help in some of those executive communications. It helps people in a leadership role if they can see a team and the team can show them, hey, this is V1. It's finished these stages. This is V1.5. It's finished these stages. This is V2. It's finished these stages. That gives people a very concrete evidence of forward motion.
Yeah.
Versus I could show you, but the model is over here and we need this thing to run it and all the data sets over there. And that's a lot harder.
So let's go a little bit deeper into that. So you mentioned communication as one of the ways to fill in the gap
yeah.
between the technical teams and the non-technical stakeholders. What else?
What else fills in the gap, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think the goals is a big one. Like I said at the very beginning, it's critical that the leaders be able to put forward goals that are going to resonate, that are going to be connected to the customer, and are going to be actionable for every one of those teams. This is something that actually I thought Amazon did a fantastic job of. It was hard. It's a lot of work to come up with those great goals, but it's worth it because if you can find a goal that is highly specific, that is very measurable, but still has that vision in it of we're going to be better for customers because of XYZ, that can really help people kind of orient their own thinking, their own work to what is going to help the business most. So I think that's important. I think spending time educating is really important. Hmm. This is a very new space and it's moving incredibly quickly. It is very easy for people to get overwhelmed. And I think that you have to put yourself into a mode of understanding that you're going to be asked the same question by the same person multiple times. And you can't shortcut the answer just because it's been asked before. The fact that it's being asked multiple times shows that it has not yet fully sunk in. You have mm-hmm. to put the same effort into answering it that you did the first time. So I think that's really important. I think you fundamentally need these teams that are currently very separate and not talking to each other to begin to work together and feel empathy for each other. I think that's really important for the data scientists to understand that the SRE is not being a pain in the butt. They're doing something. They're on the same team. They're trying to help you out, but they've got a tough job. And the same thing on the other side, that the AI model isn't non-deterministic. It's not that the data scientist is dumb and didn't know how to set mm-hmm. up a model. It's that it's going to decay. It's going to drift. And that's something that we're all going to have to work to deal with.
Yeah, so communications, understanding of goals, synergy between the two and alignment there, and that ongoing training. And the training as well, I think I'm seeing it as an issue among many organizations that are trying to get into implementing AI in one form or another. Sometimes leadership is asking, we just need AI, but they don't quite know what they're asking for. Right. But it also starts with that understanding of what AI really means, because certain organizations have been doing it for ages.
That's right.
But exec are probably just thinking of, oh, we don't have a ChatGPT like functionality within our company, and that's what we need. That's what they're referring about AI. So how can organizations really improve that AI literacy among their non-technical staff?
Yeah, I think that I've seen the most success when you have these kind of big education things that you need to do in starting with the people who have a natural curiosity in that area. And so there's a temptation to try and go fast and just say, we're just going to force everyone to go through this boot camp, or we're going to force everybody to learn this, or we're going to provide a ton of materials. I don't find that works that well. But if you can find people who are naturally curious, especially if those people are looked up to by their peers, by the groups around them, that can be incredibly powerful because then you feed them with the knowledge, you get them ramping up, you get them talking about how they're learning, why they're learning, why it's exciting, why it's valuable. And that naturally pulls people along. And it's easier if people are pulling themselves forward into education than if you're trying to yank them forward yourself. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think that's definitely what's worked for me.
Do you recommend having readily available resources, maybe like a mini training course or any form of documentation that people can go to and self-serve once they get that insight and that push from those that they respect, those that they look up to?
Yeah, I think that there's two aspects. My personal preference, and this is, I think, I'm probably more of a personal preference than there's a right way and a wrong way to do it, has been just to make it relatively easy by creating like a list of resources that are publicly available and basically mm-hmm. saying, hey, if you want to learn more about this, try these five areas. If you want to learn more about that, try these five areas. If you're just trying to get the whole thing, then follow this path through the resources. And I think that's fine. If people want to create their own materials, that's fine too. But then what is valuable, I think, is to have, like I said, have the people who are making the best progress through that, have them come back and do like a little lunch and learn type thing so they can share their journey and help people to see that, oh, I don't need to be a data scientist to understand all this. And I don't need to understand all of it. Mm-hmm. I really just need to understand these pieces. And look at this person. They've managed to pull out the pieces that they need and they're doing cool stuff with it. I want to be like that. So I think that's critical too.
Thank you so much for sharing that. From your experience, can you share some success stories or examples where enterprises have successfully integrated AI initiative into their existing workflows?
Yeah, for sure. When I was running the developer tools division at Red Hat in 2017 or 2018, it started, we had two data scientists, super, super smart women that joined the team. And at the time, the team was about 200-ish people. I don't remember exactly, but something in that range. And I would have loved to have had more data scientists, but the budget didn't really allow it. And as it turned out, that was a blessing in disguise because with only two data scientists, there was no temptation for me to say, let's create a manager and let's create a data science group. It doesn't make sense. There's two people. Of course, they have to be built into the product team. And that ended up being great for them. And it ended up being great for us because there was no choice. They had to become educated about what the product was, about who the customers were. We invited them to all the same meetings. There was never, and I made it very clear to the team at the time that because we were going to try some of these experiments, they would be forced to listen to the data science team talk about things that they didn't understand. And the data science team would be forced to listen to them talk about some things they didn't understand. But over time, they're both going to learn each other's area and they're going to start to see how it all comes together. And not everyone is happy with that original approach, that kind of co-ownership model, because it's hard, mm-hmm. but it really worked. It ended up with real empathy among the team and a real sense of cohesion of, we are all trying to build this thing for these types of customers to get these types of benefits. And the data scientists started thinking more and more about, I wonder if we did more of this, how that would help. And then the engineers and the software developers and the SREs, they could really see how these models would develop, how they would get fit in, how they would get deployed, and then see those moments of the customers going, oh, wow, this is really cool. And so I think you need to have that. I think the more you try and keep this separated, I'm even honestly very skeptical about this whole kind of trend towards an AI center of excellence. Like it sounds great, but to me, it feels like a different type of island. And mm-hmm. I think you don't want those islands. And the only downside, I should be really clear about that co-ownership model, is that it really does force a lot of handoffs. You are almost constantly handing things off between the data science and the rest of the engineering team and between the production, and it creates a lot of that motion. And so that's, again, why we wanted to start with KitOps, with that packaging that allows that kind of handoff to happen rapidly, easily, and with low risk, so that it smooths the road for this kind of a kind of organizational and cultural approach.
Right. It's funny you brought up the AI Center of Excellence. I was thinking about that For a while now, if it's a good idea or not. One way that I'm envisioning it is not having it as a separate group, but more as a like non-physical entity, if that makes sense, that kind of puts together best practices, maybe some of the training materials, common resources, things like that. You still have data scientists maybe embedded within the different business units that they're working with or with the software development team, but then this entity in a way forces them to come together from time to time, refer and use all these common resources. So they're consistent in how they're communicating back and maybe just having them as a platform to, again, come together and share lessons learned and exchange that knowledge. But again, I haven't seen an implementation that works yet.
I think what you're describing is a hub and spoke model. Right. And I think that's perfect. And I do think that there's an implementation of this that works all over the place, but it's not for AIML. But I think it's a great kind of corollary, and that's UX.
Theory.
When you think about UX, when UX started, because I'm getting old, I remember when UX was a new thing in engineering teams, that it started the same way. They were like, let's create a UX group, and they're just shoved over here. And then at the last minute, we'll come over to them and say, hey, can you just make this look pretty? And the UX people would pull their hair out because they're like, if you came to me 6 months ago, I could, but now it's too late. And now I think we've gotten to a point where we all know, put the UX people inside the projects, but then also have a kind of UX standards group or a central group that helps set what is the UX patterns that we're going to use at this company. And those UX individuals still are connected to that central group. So they still have a kind of growth path for themselves career-wise. They can share war stories and new ideas. And I think you can do this exact same thing for AIML. It feels like a more natural way to do it. Embed folks, but then do have this central group that is trying to figure out how do we amplify what each little group is learning across all the groups.
Well said. Do you have any other advice that you like to give enterprises that are looking to leverage AI tools more effectively and also collaborate more seamlessly with their AI teams?
Yeah, we talked a lot about the cultural stuff and the communication. The communication is huge. And I think you used a great word, George, of transparency. And that's another thing that I think we really want to be able to do with these model kits is give a little bit more transparency to folks. Now, I admittedly have been somewhat biased by having run API Gateway for Amazon, which does billions of transactions a second around the globe, has hugely critical customer workloads, the Super Bowl, that if things go down, it gets real ugly real fast.
Right.
But that was a fascinating experience for me because one of the things that I didn't really appreciate was the way that you match that level of scale and that level of kind of operational maturity with a product that is deploying almost constantly somewhere around the globe. There are over 100 availability zones that Amazon has now. I don't even know how many, but it's definitely well over 100. And so to keep up to date, you have to be deploying all the time. Mm-hmm. And every deployment is a risk. And so it becomes a question of how do you deploy fast, but risk-free all the time? And that takes effort and that takes tooling and process that you can trust. And so I feel like the other thing that I always try and caution people against is we have spent the last 15 years as a software community developing a DevOps culture of connection between the infrastructure teams and the software teams and developing a set of tools, pipelines, containers, standards, compliance processes that work. And so now I see something that bothers me, which is that you've got these MLOps tools, which are creating a whole parallel stack to what is already existing over here for software. That scares me a lot because it took 15 years to get this to be really smooth and really fast and really risk-free. And it is not simple to do that again. So to me, I tell organizations, they really should try and use as much as possible this infrastructure, but make it work for AIML, which is itself not easy. This was never designed for AIML, but I think greater success comes from trying to change these things to work with AIML than to try and make the AIML stuff magically do all the compliance and the security and the everything else that we have done over the last 15 years.
Well said. So looking ahead, what trends do you anticipate shaping the future of collaboration between enterprises and the AI teams?
I think there's two really interesting ones. These may be obvious to some of your listeners, I'm sure, but it feels like the AI market is going to split into two very different worlds. One is these massive general purpose LLMs from OpenAI and Google and Microsoft and everybody else. That feels like it's going to be very good for consumers, maybe small businesses, anyone who doesn't need to worry about sensitive customer data and PII and data sovereignty and all these kinds of things. And then I think on the other end, you're going to get increasingly small models that are highly specialized to specific tasks, specific industries. And those, to me, you will need to manage yourself as an organization, because you can't let your data go out into the world. You can't risk that. And so I think that's fascinating to think of this very kind of dichotomized world. And so I think one of the things that kind of comes out of that is like I said, I don't think if you roll forward and say, if I'm an enterprise, I'm going to have a number of these different small models that are highly specialized, that are doing different jobs within my company for my customers that use different data, I'm going to have to control all that. I'm going to have to secure all that. I'm going to have to make sure we're compliant with all that. And again, I don't think I want an end-to-end MLOps tool trying to do that. I think I want a lot of the same tools that I've been using, a lot of the same standards I've developed. And that's hard, because it's easy for us on the AML side to say, yeah, but we're unique. This is different. And so you need something different because this is different. And for the development side, absolutely you do. For the operational side, I'm not convinced.
Thank you so much, Brad. Thank you again for being on the Lights on Data show, putting the lights on this very important topic on fostering that synergy between enterprises and the AI teams. And I do encourage everybody to follow Brad Meekly on LinkedIn. Check out Jozu, check out kitops.ml. And until next time, let's keep putting the lights on data. Thank you so much, Brad.
Thank you very much, George. My pleasure.